Om Parataya Pativoti Tam Pagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Punanamina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Pagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavatvaishini.
Okay, let's start with verse 22 so that I can use that as a lead into verse 23 and 24 that we're going to be looking at.
Ananyas chintayanto mam ye janah paryupasate tesham nidyabhiyuktanam yoga kshema vahamyaham.
Just do the sandhi again. Ananyaha chintayantaha mam ye janaha pariyupasate tesham nitya abhiyuktanam yoga kshema vahami aham. A few verses before this, we were talking again about the samsari, about the vaidika, who does rituals and whatnot in order to get to Swargaloka or to different heaven worlds, but they go and then they have to come back. They're always coming back to Matsyaloka. So as long as we are praying for something within the loka, within this universe, right, we're in duality. And so we're expending our punya and papa, so to speak, you know, any kind of karma that we do is going to give us a limited result. The karma, the action is limited, the result is limited. That means the result comes to an end. That means that we come back. Okay. That's a little piece of logic there. Okay. So no karma is going to give a limitless result. No action that you do can give a limitless result. The action itself takes place in time and space. The result takes place in time and space. So the limited can't produce the limitless. And so all of these verses we're talking, before this verse 22, these few verses, we're talking about those who are going to doing their vaidikas, they're living a dharmic life, they're doing all of the rituals and prayers, in order to get to Swargaloka, or to get to a world of experience that is still within duality, even though it's a punya bhumi. Punya bhumi means it's a world that is a manifestation of punya, means everything is fine for you at that time. That punya bhumi comes to an end. So these were the preceding verses. Now in verse 22, which we were doing last week, it says, the other, however, he says, those people who worship me, means Ishwara, with a mind which is not dual, and whether it's the mind that is not focused on another, which means if I'm worshiping Ishwara, worshiping, the Lord says, those people who are worshiping me, their mind not being ananya, mean focused on any other thing, on any second thing. For them, for those people, I take care of their yoga. Those people who are always united with me, I take care of their yogic kshema. Whereas for the others, the yogic kshema is something that comes and goes. And yogic kshema means the yoga are those, the acquiring of those things that I desire. The kshema is protecting the things that I get. The desired objects that I receive, kshema means to protect those. Yoga means to acquire them, the acquiring of them. Kshema is the protecting of them. So for a samsari, somebody whose desires are objects within the world, something that is obtained within duality, something that is other than me, right? And so there's a separation between the subject and object. Therefore, since that separation is there, I have a desire for it. I want this so that I can be happy. So there's a dvaita, there's a duality there. And so I make efforts, I do rituals, I do prayers, I do all kinds of things to try to acquire this. And then having acquired it, having made all of these efforts, then I finally acquire it through all of my efforts. Then I pray to Bhagawan. I pray to Bhagawan to help me to acquire this, you know, to give me the punya, to give me the grace, to give me whatever I need to remove the obstacles so that I can fulfill this desire. So I'll pray to Bhagawan, the Lord, for that. And then once I get it, I'll pray to Bhagawan, please help me, you know, to protect this, you know, to keep this. Don't let it be taken from me. And so there I'm making all of the effort for my own yoga kshema and asking the Lord to come in and give me a hand. Here, though, for a jnani, for that one who thinks of me, of Ishwara, as not different from myself. So those people, those jnanis or mumukshus, really, who recognize Ishwara as being my very being, as being my very self, for those people, there is no duality. So this whole creation, in fact, is Ishwara, and this body, mind, sense organs, everything that makes me an individual, you know, jiva, actually is part and parcel of Ishwara. And so this jiva itself is Ishwara. The prarabdha is it, the jiva is Ishwara, the prarabdha is Ishwara. There is no separation. And so therefore, if this is whole, one whole, Ishwara, then that Ishwara, whatever the life, whatever Ishwara's unfoldment may be, is Ishwara's yogakshema, which is my yogakshema. See what I mean? It's not that I'm saying, because my being is Ishwara. As Brahman, the conscious being that I am, that is the self of Ishwara. And this body, the whole infinite body of Ishwara, which includes this body, mind, sense organs, right? That also is myself. The creation comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. It is really nothing but me. If that is the understanding, then when I'm, say, a bhakta, or I worship Ishwara, or I pray to Ishwara, who am I praying to? It's I don't see Ishwara as another, where I'm a jiva in relationship to Ishwara, who is other than me. Rather, this jiva is part and parcel of Ishwara. That means that also the prarabdha karma is part and parcel of Ishwara. The whole, the total manifest creation with all of the laws that hold together as one entity, included in that one entityness of Ishwara, is your prarabdha karma. The prarabdha karma are the karmas that caused you to take this birth and would take you all the way through to your death. And so, in fact, that prarabdha karma, which is Ishwara's, in sense, that takes care of your yogic kshema, you know? In fact, one nice thing for a jnani, one nice understanding to live by in terms of this is that, you know, if it's mine, in terms of if that's in my prarabdha, then I will get that. It's good for a mumukshu. If it's in my prarabdha karma, I'll get that. Nobody can take it away from me. It's mine. It's the prarabdha. You know, that's my little piece of it. That's Ishwara manifest in this particular arena of this jiva's prarabdha karma. If it's mine, I'll get it. And nobody can do anything about that. And if it's not mine, I definitely won't get it. You know? And so you can relax. The things that are yours, you'll get. Nobody will take it away. And the things that aren't yours, you won't get. So it's all right. It's not yours. So that's all tied up in this, where you see the whole creation as Ishwara. And that means the things that come to you, the things that are coming to you moment by moment by moment, day by day by day, that's yoga, that's the yoga. Okay? And so Bhagawan says, I take care of that yoga. You know? And the things that stay, that's the kshema. I take care of that yoga kshema. You don't have to worry about it. It's already a done deal. The only problem comes in when that jiva comes up, you know, that little jiva head, the head raises, that's kind of a jnana head of the jiva. It says, Bhagawan is not taking care of my yoga kshema. Why? Because I want this yoga kshema, not this one. See what I mean? For everybody, the yoga kshema is there. In this sense, for every human being, things are coming and things are staying, and then things are going away. And every moment, things are coming to you, and then things are staying. Even if you want them to go, Bhagawan can say, no, kshema, I'm protecting these things, I'm keeping them with you. You know? But you might be thinking, this thing's coming to me, and I wanted this to come to me. That's the jiva. For the jnani is, this is coming, this is Ishvara, right? This is Ishvara. What is coming is Ishvara. What is staying is Ishvara. What is going away is Ishvara. That's the yogakshema. So for the jnani, there's no problem, because I'm not asking for my own variant of what my yogakshema should be. Right? That's the jiva. What about when that's what we call jiva srishti. You know, there's Ishvara srishti, there's the creation that is there that includes me, the body, mind, sense organs. That's the Ishvara srishti. Srishti means creation. That's the Lord's creation, objectively. And then, upon that, there is the jiva srishti, the jiva's creation, the individual's creation that is projected upon that. The jiva srishti that's projected, the subjective projection of the individual upon the objective creation of Ishvara, is problematic when the two don't meet. You know, because the Ishvara srishti is just going to go on as it does. And if the jiva srishti doesn't match it, then the jiva srishti is going to get squashed, because the jiva srishti is subjective. The Ishvara srishti is objective. You know, it's like saying, say if you have the rope projection on the snake projection on the rope. One is a projection. One is an objective reality. So one has much more staying power than the other, right? The one that has an objective reality, a shared reality, you know, is much more substantial than the projection upon it. Jiva srishti is a projection. It's a mental projection. I want it to be like this. And then you feel wonderful if the way that you want it to be matches how it is. When the way you want it to be doesn't match how it is, then that's a source of dukkha. Okay? Now, what if the way you want it to be is not different than the way it is, because you accept the way it is as Ishvara, and you're a bhakta, so to speak, toward Bhagavan. You're a jnani bhakta, and you have knowledge, and you have a relationship with Ishvara, which is one of understanding that all of this is Ishvara, this body, mind, sense organs is taken care of Ishvara, by Ishvara, as part and parcel of Ishvara. And so the yoga kshema also is Ishvara. Right? And so as long as I'm not asking, have a jiva srishti upon the creation, then whatever is the yoga kshema of Ishvara is fine. Because yeah? I'm not asking it to be different. I'm not asking it to be different, though, because I have knowledge, because I know what the source of ananda is, which is my own being. If the mind hasn't had that ajnanam, that ignorance removed, then all these things, I'm then an entity within duality, trying to carve out my little yoga kshema, my little piece of happiness out of this, you know, by being able to experience things just exactly the way that I want them, so that my mind will be relaxed for that moment, so that I'll experience some happiness. That's what we do. That's very precarious. We're really, it's the whole thing is a projection upon reality, and trying to make that projection hang in there for a moment. Whereas the Ishvara srishti and the jiva srishti come into kind of a resonance for that moment, so that my mind can relax. And in that moment, you know, it's like the sun reflecting in a clear water bucket. And I experience some ananda. That's the precarious situation of a samsari. It's very, very precarious. It isn't at all precarious for a jnani, because the jnani is not looking to fulfill their own yoga kshema, because seeing this whole thing is Ishvara, and this body, mind, sense organ is a part and parcel of Ishvara. The yogic kshema and the prarabdha karma being one and the same thing. So if I accept my prarabdha karma, then Ishvara takes care of the yogic kshema. So this is the verse that we did. For those who are nitya abhiyuktaha, for such people like that, means they never see themselves as separate from me. So that means nitya. Always they see themselves as one with me. For such a person, I as Ishvara take care of the yogic kshema. There's that problem, it doesn't exist, you know. However, And this next verse, we go, let's chant this. Ye apyan devata devata bhaktaha. Ye apyan yad devata bhaktaha. Yajante shradayan vitaha. Yajante shradayan vitaha. Tepi mame vakanteya. Tepi mame vakanteya. Yajantya vidipurvakam. Yajantya vidipurvakam. Ye api anya devata bhaktaha. Ye api anya devata bhaktaha. Yajante shraddhaya anyataha. Te api mam eva kanteya yajanti avidhi purvakam. Avidhi purvakam. Okay. He goes, these next two, 23 and 24, are a little bit of a set. He says, those people also, ye api, those also who are anya devata bhaktaha. Those people who yajante means they worship, in Tulsi there, they worship me. Those people who worship me, who are bhaktas to a devata, who they one of the devatas, any like the Agni devata, any devata, Ganesha, doesn't make any of the devatas. They are devotees of the devata as being anya, different from me and different from Ishwara both. Say if I'm a Krishna bhakta, or a Shiva bhakta, or I'm a Ganapati bhakta, or a Saraswati bhakta. I worship that particular devata as being separate from me, subject object, and also being separate from Ishwara. Then there's Ishwara and all of these other devatas, or there. That's one way of looking at it. Take it in both ways. And then there's me, who am a bhakta of you. Right? So there's no recognition of all of the devatas as being part and parcel of Ishwara, right? And of Ishwara having been my own self, my own being. It isn't that. I'm a jiva, limited jiva, and I am devoted to a devata in a particular form. Not seeing the devata like, say, Shiva, for instance, as being an aspect of Ishwara, or Brahmaji as an aspect of Ishwara, Vishnu as an aspect of Ishwara, Ganesha as an aspect of Ishwara, whether it's really just Ishwara. I don't see it like that. I am a bhakta of that particular devata, you know, who is different than all of the other devatas and who is different from me. So now Bhagavan says, those people, you know, who worship a devata as being separate. So those people who worship a devata in this form, and they worship shraddhaya anvitaha, and they worship with endowed with shraddha, means they have devotion and belief. They have, you know, faith. So they worship that devata with faith and devotion, you know, as being different from them, so subject-object relationship. He says, te api mam eva kanteya, hey kanteya. He says, those people, those ones, they are also worshiping me. They're only worship me. It's just that they're avidipurvakam. It's just that worship is associated with ajnanam, with ignorance. You know, it's just that particular way of worshiping me has ajnanam. You know, is preceded by or is full of ajnanam, ignorance. Right. But whether there's ignorance there or not, they're still worshiping me, because I can have a relationship with a devata, or even with my idea of Ishwara, Ishwara in the form of Krishna, Krishna is Ishwara, you know, but But Krishna is Ishwara, but Ishwara is not Krishna. There's a subject-object relationship. Whereas if for instance, a jnani is worshipping Krishna or Shiva or Vishnu or any devata, you see that as just an embodiment of Ishwara. It is Ishwara. That's so. So for that person, they're worshipping Ishwara in one of Ishwara's manifestations, but you're still worshipping Ishwara. If you are worshipping, say, Krishna, and you're worshipping Krishna as being separate from you, other than you, a separate devata who is your devata, that's the one that you're worshipping, you're still worshipping Ishwara, whether you know it or not. Because anything within the creation is only me, is what Krishna is saying. Because everything, every being in the creation, every devata in the creation, every aspect of the creation is only me. And so whatever you're worshipping in the creation, you are worshipping me. You just don't know it. That's the only difference. For a jnani, they know it. So whatever, in a verse that's coming two verses from now, Krishna says, you know, in whatever form you worship me, you know, I receive that. You know, it doesn't matter. Whatever offering you make to me, I receive that offering. In every way you worship me, I receive that worship, you know. Because nothing is away from me. Whatever form you evoke me in, I receive that. I'm fine with that, you know. Because there isn't anything other than me. So here, he's saying that the jnani is the one who sees me as I am, as the whole. And so if I recognize Ishwara as the whole, then every experience that I have is only Ishwara, including this experience of this body, mind, sense organs, and including my devotion of the Lord in any particular form. And I'm worshiping the Lord in that form. We can worship the Lord in any form we want, knowing that there is nothing really but Ishwara, you know? And so what is really the difference between a person who is worshiping Krishna and another person who is worshiping Krishna? They're still worshiping Krishna, you know. But one sees Krishna as an embodiment of Ishwara, and one sees Krishna as Krishna, you know, as a jiva almost, as a jiva devata, as a devata only. And so that's the. But whatever they're doing, whether their worship is backed by avidya, by ajnana, or it's not, they're still worshiping me. You know, if you think about it, I like to think about these things in terms of if you imagine the dream, if you have a dream, you know, say you have a lucid dream, or let's go back to my meadow. If you have a meadow, you know, and there's many people in the meadow, you know, and some people in the meadow are jnanis, they're meadow jnanis, right? They know what it is. They know what the meadow is. They know what that projection is. They know what is going on. And they know who they are. If they know who they are, say you have right now you have a meadow imagination with many people in the meadow, and some of the people are jnanis, what do they know? They know that myself is the self of the whole meadow. And that, in fact, this whole meadow is an expression of me. And that I, the jiva, within this meadow, am nothing but part and parcel of the meadow. And in fact, myself is the self of the entire meadow. That's what they know. They have self-knowledge, right? And so now, if they worship the tree, who are they worshiping? Ishwara, because they already know I am the whole. And so if they worship Ishwara, they relate to Ishwara in the form of the tree, or in the form of the sky, or in the form of the nature, or in the form of a devata. Whatever form that they're evoking is only Ishwara. Right? And they know that because they know that I'm the whole. Whereas another, the people in the meadow that are in the meadow imagination that are ajnanis, if they worship the tree, they have a ritual and a worship that they have shraddha in, you know, in evoking the grace of the tree, or in invoking the grace of that particular devata within duality. They have no idea that I am the whole, right? And that there's only one self there, which is manifest as Ishwara as the whole, and that every part of it is only Ishwara. So it's a different vision, You know, one had one. There's either still a jnana there, the other one there's not a jnana. But when they're worshiping the tree is Ishwara, you know, that whether or not the person knows it, that's the idea. Whether one has a jnana there, one doesn't have a jnana, but it's still exactly the same. So that's all he says in this verse. You know, whether they worship with Shraddha, if they're worshiping me in a particular form as being different from them, full of Shraddha, they're still worshiping me, and I receive that also. I don't take that badly. Bhagavan says, I don't take that badly. That's fine. They're evoking me in that form, and that is me. You know? And so I receive that. It's fine. But there's a difference. One has ajnanam, one has ignorance, and the other doesn't. So let's do this next verse. Oh, this goes with it.
Aham hi sarva yajnanam. Aham hi sarva yajnanam. Bhokta cha prabhureva cha. Bhokta cha prabhureva cha. Natu mam apijananti. Natu mam abhijananti. Tetvena tas chivanti mitite. Tetvena tas chivanti te. Aham hi sarva yajnanam bhoktaha cha prabhu eva cha na tu mam abhijananti tetvena attaha chivanti te.
He says he is because aham sarva yajnanam bhokta and prabhu cha prabhu eva cha, because of all of the yajnas, of all of the rituals, all of the different forms of worship that are done, all of the pujas, all of the rituals, yajna is usually more Vaidika, but all of the rituals, all of the karmas that are done, I am the bhokta, I am the enjoyer, I am the one who receives all of that, aham bhokta, and I am prabhu, I am the Lord, I am the one for whom all of these things are done, for all of the yajnas. The yajnas that are done in the Vedas, there's so many yajnas, there's so many rituals that are done to so many different devatas in order to gain so many different results. There's so many rituals that are done to achieve given results. Like maybe I'm doing, you know, an Agnihotra, different types of rituals so that I can get to Swargaloka. Or maybe I'm doing some rituals in order to bring the rains, or I'm doing some rituals, Vedic rituals, in order to have a child. There's so many rituals that can be done. Then there's rituals that are done just because they're my duty. All of these rituals that are done for all of them, whether they're done in order to achieve some sort of a loka, some sort of a heaven world experience, or they're done in order to fulfill some sort of a desire, I'm the Lord of all of those rituals. And I'm the one to whom those rituals come. In other words, I'm the bhokta. I'm the one who receives all of those rituals. You know, it's kind of like saying, and in fact, there's verses that do say this, if I look, when my eyes are open now, with my eyes open and my mind back in my eyes, I'm receiving through my eyes, you know, all of this input, sight, everything that I'm perceiving, all of the names and forms in this room are now as though being given to me. I'm the bhokta of all of these, right? Who is the bhokta of all? This is the conscious being. What is inert is not going to be a bhokta. Bhokta means the one who enjoys, who receives it all. So the bhokta, Ishwara is the bhokta, right? Ishwara is the one who receives all of this, just like for you. You, the conscious being, the jiva, from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, all of the experiences that you have, you know, are being received. All of the experiences that you have through all of your sense perception, for instance, you know, and all of the thoughts in your mind, the moods and the emotions, all of these things are being given to you. They're offerings to you. Who is the you? The conscious being, right? And so I am the only one really who receives all of this. And so I am the bhokta, and I am the Lord of all of this, of all of the of all of the karmas, of all of the rituals that are being done, there's no other conscious being there, you know. You can even think of it in terms of, if you think of it in terms of your dream or in terms of the meadow, if in the meadow there are many experiences taking place in the meadow, think of even, there's the experience of the whole meadow, right? And so the whole meadow is known, right? Is known to who? You have to say it's known to Bhagawan, right? It's known to Bhagawan, the whole meadow, right? It's not known to something which is inert. It's only known to consciousness. You know, it's a manifestation of consciousness. It's known to consciousness. You can talk like that. From the standpoint of the meadow, it's known to consciousness. From the standpoint of consciousness, there's only consciousness that's not knowing anything. But from the standpoint of the meadow, from the standpoint of duality, it is only known to consciousness. The consciousness was not there, there'd be nothing to, no being to receive it, right? And so, take the whole meadow is known to consciousness, you know? And everything in the meadow, everybody's experience in the meadow, is known to consciousness. It's not known to inertness. It's not known to non-consciousness. And so, if you think of yourself as a jiva, every experience that you have is, in a sense, an offering to consciousness. It's like, you know, when you're throwing flowers to the deity, all the experiences are like throwing flowers to giving gifts to Ishwara, giving gifts to consciousness. So there's verses like that. So here he's saying, I am the Lord of all of the rituals. I am the Bhokta. I am the one who all of these, to whom all of these offerings are made. It doesn't matter what the ritual is. He says, but na tu mam abhijananti, but they not knowing me, in truth, tatvena, they not knowing me as I am, he says, therefore, attaha chivantite, they fall away from me, as though, not knowing me, they fall away from me. What they mean by fall away from me is that the rituals, all of the rituals which are done, even though I'm receiving all of those, for them the ritual is being offered to a devata in order to gain a result that which is within samsara. Even if the result is going away to a heaven, their ritual and their offerings are not resolving into me to know me, to become one with me, to gain knowledge. It's not that. It's all of these rituals which are being done and which I'm receiving as Bhagawan, I'm receiving. In spite of all of that, because they don't know me, they are falling away from me in the sense that they're going out into the world in order to attain that karmapala, a karmapala, a result of action which is away from me. See what I mean? Nothing's really away from me. But if, say, I look over there and I say, I want that so I can be happy. That's what they mean by falling away. Lord, I'm going to do this ritual in order to evoke your grace so that I can have that. Mm-hmm. That's the jivanti. That's the moving away. You're moving in the wrong direction. In terms of knowledge. Instead of doing the ritual for antakarna shuddhi, I'm doing these rituals, you know, in order to purify my mind so that I can gain knowledge, so that I can know you, you know. So therefore the mumukshu, the pulla of the, what I'm asking for from the karma, from the rituals that I do, from the karma yoga that I do, from all the austerities that I do, what I'm asking for is self-knowledge. I'm asking for you, for Ishwara. That's what I want. I want Ishwara. I want to know myself. I want that resolution. What if I'm doing all of the rituals and all of the austerities so that I can gain more powers, or so that I can gain a particular loka, or gain this object or that object? Then I'm doing with Shraddha all of these rituals, but the result of the ritual is something that takes me more into samsara, not toward you. Nothing wrong with it. We're not talking about a dharma, doing something adharmic. We're talking about vaidikas who are actually following dharma, but what they are seeking takes them in the opposite direction of what they're truly seeking. What they're seeking takes them in the opposite direction of what they're really seeking. Because what a person is really seeking through the attainment or fulfillment of desires is so that now I can be happy. I want this so that I can be happy, so that I can be whole, so that I can be complete. I don't want this so I can be miserable. You know, we fulfill our desires, we pursue things because we think that this pursuit or this attainment or that attainment will make me whole. You know, even cumulatively, I thought, well, if I have this and this and this and this and this and this and all of these things come together properly, then I'll be a whole and complete person. That's what we think. And so we go after these things. You know? So that is the samsara. The mumukshutvam is when that desire for liberation comes and you realize that that actually doesn't work. I projected the ananda onto the world and then I'm seeking it. You know, so then as long as I believe that, if I could just fulfill this desire or that desire, and then I would be happy, then I would say to Bhagavan, who is another, an other out there, Bhagavan, please help me to get this so that I can be happy. Okay? That's what it is. That's when we do all of these rituals and all of these prayers, so that I can arrange the world in such a way so that I can be happy, and we evoke Bhagavan's grace to give us that. You know? But there comes a time when you realize that that's not true. You know, we can get those things. We can get all of those things, maybe. And some of them we won't get. You know, but we can get some of them. But we do get them, and we don't get what we thought we were going to get from getting them. So what we thought we were going to get from getting them is wholeness and completeness. You know? So in the end, you know, the mind does not ask for that. What the mind wants is to whatever actions I do, whatever rituals or prayers that are enjoined upon me to do, whatever are my duties, I do those with a sense of karma yoga. You know, so recognizing, let me gain the antikarma shuddhi, or that purity of mind, peace of mind, dharmic mind, so that I can gain this knowledge, so that I can recognize you, so that I can know you, so that I can gain you, so that I can be that nitya abhiyuktanam, so I can always be one with you, that my mind doesn't take me out into the samsara. You know? For a bhakta who sees Bhagavan as other, then, you know, what happens is, not knowing me, even though Bhagavan says I'm receiving all of the rituals, and I'm the lord of all of the rituals, still doing the rituals and not knowing me, those rituals take you away. Take you away means take you back into the samsara. You know, as though take you away. You're never really away, but you're as though. You're as though take it away. Okay, let's stop there. Do the next week.
Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamidachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
I have a question about, I don't mean this to be abstract, but if all is Ishwara, it's his manifestation, even this sense of separation or the sense of a jiva or the sense that if I get this, I'll be complete, that's, how do you see that? Because that's Ishwara also.
It's Ishwara with Ajnanam. You know, it's the Ajnanam is part of Ishwara also, not from Ishwara's standpoint, but from the standpoint of the jiva.
Mm-hmm.
Ajnanam is there from the standpoint of the jiva. Right?
So, like, say, what if you sense like there's a separation or a need to protect something? You know? You see that as...
The whole thing is Ishwara.
So that...
Even the need to protect.
So when you notice this need to protect... that's not born out of ignorance, but it's Ishwara himself.
Well, there can't be something that's outside of Ishwara, you know. But now say, like for instance, the rope is Ishwara, and the snake is Ishwara also. Right? Because the possibility of the snake has to be there, or it can't be there.
Mm.
Right? So there isn't anything that can occur that's outside of Ishwara. So now, say from Ajnani, from an ignorant standpoint,
mm-hmm.
you work to get something and then you get it and then you know you really have to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a couple of ways you can look at that. Say, for instance, you get something, it needs to be protected, and so you have the vritti, the inclination,
yeah.
to protect it.
Yeah.
That's natural.
Yeah.
But now, what if... And that's all within in the order. You're still fine. But now what starts being generated is all kinds of angst around whether, you know, that need to that the protection that you have a inclination to do, a natural inclination to do, is generating for you all kinds of worry,
mm-hmm.
you know, about whether or not you're going to be able to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, say you have kind of natural instincts. A human being, we have natural instincts. There's natural laws. Those things are going to arise in us. But what do they generate? Do they arise in us as something natural, which is objective for us, or something that creates like a subjective turmoil? So we say the subjective turmoil belongs to the jiva, right?
Mm-hmm.
It belongs, it's created by the jiva, but the jiva can create that because of Ajnanam. So the creation of that is also Ishwara.
Mm-hmm.
That's why sometimes Swamiji does these meditations that I think are so nice, where, say, for instance, you're in a situation where you're experiencing all this angst, like you're worried about this and that happening,
yeah.
you know? So then you can objectify that whole situation that you find yourself in and then see what went into on all sides of this feeling is being generated. You see who the players are in your imagination. You just see who all of the players are and the things that are involved in producing this angst. You know? And you take it back, cause, effect. It's always complex. You know, any production of anything in the creation is complex. There's all these variables that are involved. But you can start realizing, well, this happened, and then this happened on this side, and on this side, this, and all of these things coming together have now produced this feeling. This feeling that you're suffering from is a production. It's been produced. right, because it wasn't there before, it took all of these things to happen, to bring to fruition this particular feeling. And so when you see that, then you see it as Ishvara. You know?
Then you do what?
You see it as Ishvara. This was produced. This feeling was produced because of all of these variety of variables. You know? Including, the more, say, that you have knowledge, then you also see your own vairagya and lack of it, you know, in reference to that, or your own fears. This particular situation triggers fear in you, you know, and so then you see, why is that? You know, what is triggering that fear? Why am I afraid? Why is that kind of pulling me out of myself? Why is that pulling me out of my knowledge? Those are good, it's a good mananam, it's a good kind of a nididhyasana, really, you know, where you're bringing yourself home.
But you're still a yani, even though all these dynamics are going on, you're still...
You have knowledge with pratibandhakas. Pratibandhakas, you know, we call it pratibandhaka jnanam. Pratibandhaka means like an obstruction. But it doesn't mean that you don't have knowledge, because these obstructions or complexes or things that seem to carry me away, right? They seem to carry the mind away. They are carrying the mind away, okay? Into the land of samsara, however you want to say it, carrying the mind away into all these problems and all these things. But you know what? They are the ones that the turmoil that's being created comes to an end. Your knowledge doesn't. The turmoil rises and sets in your knowledge. And even though when the turmoil is happening and taking you on a wild ride, maybe creating a lot of angst, a lot of problems for you, it will subside just like a stormy sea, you know. It will subside. And your knowledge is still there. You know, you're still there. And it's always that way. The turmoil can make you think that you're lost, but it will subside, and then there you still are, there your knowledge is there, everything's fine. Only thing is, we think, well, am I always going to have this turmoil? Is this turmoil always going to be there, or am I always going to be as though losing myself? You know, the mind takes its own time to all of the different parts of it, all of the different complexes, all of the different areas of where there's neediness, all of the different, you know, weaker parts of the mind or more immature parts of the mind. They, at their own pace, they grow and integrate this knowledge. You know, the bonfire story I've been talking about? You know, it takes a while for that bonfire, you know, for the flame to become strong enough to start consuming the whole bonfire, so then the wind and even rain doesn't bother it. It doesn't care about the rain. It just dries the rain up. As the rain is pouring down, the fire just dries it up. The wind comes, it just, you know, feeds the fans, the fire. And then slowly, but even then, when the fire is flaming, you don't need to protect the fire anymore. There's still some logs of wood that need to be burnt. You know, they need to be consumed.
Yeah. Well, what would you say if it's all Ishvara and it's prarabdha karma, and you have knowledge of yourself? Could you also say maybe that neediness would be throughout your entire lifetime if you saw that as what?
Well, say for instance, this is getting more into psychology. Like say, which is fine.
Okay.
Say there's. You know, like when we're young, there's whatever the different things that happen to us, some are more, you know, intense than others. We're there. I mean, for each one of us as an individual, there are certain things that were very formative in our young years especially. And for some people, had more trauma than others. Mm-hmm. Everybody's had trauma. There's nobody escapes it. But some have had more trauma than others, or more trauma in a certain area. And so, say that goes very much into the structure of your personality, you know? And so, even just in therapy, without knowledge at all, you don't totally get rid of some of those insecurities or tendencies of mind. But you learn how to handle them in such a way that they're not problematic. You learn how to hold them. This is just within therapy. You learn how to hold them, to be with them in a way that instead of a infected pussy scar, they just become a scar. Right? Like initially, say if you have a wound, that the wound can get infected and can be pussy and swollen and sore. And you can't, if anybody even gets near it to touch it, it causes a lot of pain. You know? But, you know, with care, that gash, that wound, that infected wound, heals. You know? And even the redness, the inflammation goes away, the infection goes away. And it heals nicely, sir. It heals really nicely. But there's still a scar there. There's still a scar. You know, and so you can look at that scar as being some part of your character. It's like somebody, Swamiji sometimes has said, you know, talking about as you get old and, you know, your hair turns gray and you gain some wrinkles. So, you know, in your face, you gain some wrinkles. He says, you've earned those wrinkles. Those are your wrinkles. Those are your character, you know? And so, kind of like that, the psyche also grows up, you know, and gains character by all of the experiences that you've had when you're a child. We're not all just cookie cutters. We've, you know, been formed by some of our experiences, and some of those create certain sensitivities, you know? So maybe you'll have some of those sensitivities your whole life. Mm-hmm. But there'll be scars, not pussy infected wounds. But that tendency is still there. Yeah.
And then the idea of seeing it all as Ishvara, how do you tie that into what you just described?
Well, for once your knowledge is clear, the pussy wound is Ishvara as well as the nice clean scar. In psychology, they use an example that I've liked. Just imagine two very kind of expensive twin vases, china vases, very delicate, you know, beautiful vases, and they're both exactly the same, except one had been knocked over and made into many pieces. The other one hadn't. But they brought in a master craftsman, you know, to put those pieces back together. And so now, the two vases are there for the outside, for the regular eye. They look exactly the same, right? But they're not the same. One has had a different experience than the other. And so even though it's well knit and it's been put together beautifully, still those cracks that have healed are still there. And for the other, they're not there.
You know? They won't sound the same either.
They won't sound the same. And so say if we look at each one of our psyches, it's like a vase that's been dropped and put together, put back together nicely, hopefully. But, you know, there's these different lines and cracks in it that make your character and your sensitivity. Of course, each one of those lines, each one of those cracks, you know, is a point of empathy for you, for others. Mm-hmm. Each line is a compassion for you. You know, because we can, not that you can't be compassionate for what you haven't experienced, but if you have experienced it and you know how to hold it, then you know how to help another person. You have empathy for that other person's experience. You can be compassionate and hold another person's experience, but you don't really have empathy in the sense of really knowing or understanding. And so you can have some respect for your wounds. You know, your wounds are the ways that you can give to others. We know that in psychology, but in Vedanta, it's also very, very true. You know? And then Vedanta, you're giving what is fact, the only thing that's free from wounds. is the Atma, yes. Right? But that self needs to be able to hold, you know, the psyche that's been through so much, especially in this era, you know, and to hold it in a way that, and to the degree that you can hold others and kind of hold you yourself and see, you know, see the order, see Ishwara in it. You know, you can do that for others.
Well, you unfolded that so beautifully, clearly, but there's still some doubts that are coming up for me in regards to the praying for something to a particular deity. If I would be praying for the word ignorance in here, the word ignorance triggered me, because that sounded to me like, you know, a definite no-no for somebody who wants.
It can't be a no-no. Ignorance is there or it's not. You know what I mean? It's not. Ignorance is not a criticism.
That's how I saw it.
Yeah, but it can't. Ignorance can't be a criticism. Ignorance is beginningless, so it's not a criticism. But now, say you're gaining knowledge, then, or say you have, let's say you have knowledge, self-knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And then say you have self-knowledge of your meadow imagination. You know, you can still recognize the whole meadow and everything in it, including all of the devatas, everything, absolutely all of the laws, all of the devatas, all of the objects, everything, everything, single thing in every dimension is the manifestation of Ishwara. That is known to you. And that includes this body, mind, sense organs. And within that knowledge, I can have, you know, I can worship the Lord in any form I want to. It doesn't mean that I don't know that everything is Ishwara, but I can still worship Ishwara in this form, or evoke Ishwara in a given form. Because say, if I, like in Rudram, say I want to evoke Ishwara's strength in this particular situation. I want to evoke Ishwara to take care of this particular situation. So I'm invoking him in a particular form. You know, I'm asking him for a particular thing. All the while knowing that I'm the whole.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of it.
So you can know that you're the whole, and at the same time be needy to...
Well, it's a mitya neediness, though. Mm-hmm. See, like, say I need you to do this for me. That's on vivahara, that's on empirical reality. I need you to do this for me. But is it my ananda at stake? Is my vision at stake? Because I need you to do this for me? It's not a stake at all, because what if you don't do this for me? I'll say, well, I needed you to do this for me, and you didn't do it. And so that didn't happen. That's the end of it. But what if I say, I needed you to do this for me, you didn't do it, and now you've really ruined my life.
Yeah.
Because are you talking you needing you to Ishwara, or you as a person that...
I'm talking even as a person. Like, say, here, I realize that I am the whole, this is all only Ishwara, and you and I are talking, right?
Mm.
We're having a relationship, you know? And I'm having a relationship with you, We're having a relationship, you know? But that doesn't mean that I don't see all of this as Ishwara. You see all of it as Ishwara, and you still have a body, mind, sense organs, and you're still in relationship. And so say, I see all of this as Ishwara, you know, and I'm fond of Krishna. I'm fond of that devata, Krishna.
Or Dakshinamurti.
Or Dakshinamurti. I'm fond of Dakshinamurti. I have that relationship with Dakshinamurti. That doesn't mean that I don't see everything as Ishwara, including Dakshinamurti. Or otherwise, how can we have, what would the alternative be? Would it be that we can't have a relationship, but we can't talk, or that we can't do things for each other, and we can't, you know, be engaged with each other? Because if I can be engaged with you and still know I'm the whole. I can certainly be engaged with Dakshinamurti and know I'm the whole, and Dakshinamurti is an aspect of Ishvara. And I can still be as engaged as I want. And I can evoke Dakshinamurti to do this, that, or the other thing.
Now, this knowledge is well known, very well known when we're in the class. It can also be very well known when we sort of are outside the class, and we can be also brought into the mind when it's necessary. But it comes at a point where as though that knowledge is lost, and the mind sort of gets itself into a spin or emotion,
yeah,
sort of thing. It's only a transitory thing, but while it is transitory, it seems real. So you can say
you know, it's amazing how real this feels. And appreciate Maya. Yeah. You know.
It's a little spice that it.
How intense it can be. Yeah. How intense the emotions can be. How real it can seem when your mind gets carried away like that.
Yeah.
But just notice over and over and over again, without exception, that your knowledge is what withstands the intensity of those emotions. But when those emotions are there, like when a complex is up, a complex, you know, that comes from the unconscious, childhood complex comes, it is absolutely real. You know? What you feel, you're reading the environment and other people in a particular way under the under the influence of that emotion, of that complex, it is real. You know, it's real, and it's very hard for you to say this is a complex.
Yeah.
You know, because it seems so very real. But what happens is, time and again, that real complex will fade away, will fall down, will go back into the unconscious, go back into its lair, kind of, you know, so you're not being overwhelmed by it. And then you see that it's not real. Oh my God, that really...
It's gone.
It's gone, and that what I was believing to be true is not true. Yeah. Okay, so this is just in the world of subjective, the power of the complex. Complexes are very strong like that. Emotions are strong. And so you have to get yourself into, in terms of these complexes, and in incredible the strength of these emotions, to at least be able to say something like, this may be a complex. even though I don't believe it, I believe this is real, where how I'm seeing it is real. I know from past experience that this is going to be a complex. Because a real complex is that powerful, that when it's happening, there's no buddhi there, you know, no intellect there to have kind of a vantage point to look from the outside. That's when, you know, you're really overwhelmed by a big one. But there comes a time, there does come a time when you're working on these particular ones that are, you know, strong in you, to where you recognize it. And that relationship between the buddhi and the complex,
mm-hmm.
Withstands the complex.
Mm-hmm. Or you know it will.
You know it will, and it does.
Always.
Yeah, then it always does.
Mm.
And then at that time, then now you can mother and take care of and handle that complex. And it doesn't overwhelm you, right? But that takes some time. You know?
See, it's what comes and goes. You think that's permanent.
When it's there, it's so real, you think it's permanent. You can't see outside of it.
No.
That's the real complex. But you know, you get used to it when that overwhelming emotion or whatever it is over. That's the time then to do some vichara, some to bring your knowledge in and to look at that whole situation and bring in, you know, some sort of auto suggestion. Next time this happens, I'm going to remember this to try to give the Buddhi some strength.
And I'm going to keep my mouth shut and not take it out on somebody else.
Yeah. I mean, these are the things that are hard, you know?
Yeah.
There's all kinds of easy stuff,
yeah.
You know, where I think that I don't want to speak in that way, or I don't want to do this, or I can improve my behavior in this way or that way. That's a lot easier than some of these complexes that are so overwhelming, you know, and one by one they shrink in size because of your care, because of your working with them, you know.
Well, Swamiji called and gave us a small meditation. He called here.
Uh-huh.
And he said that it's how you hold these things, not that you get rid of them.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. How you initially with a complex, the problem is that you can't hold it.
Yeah.
Because the complex or the emotion is much bigger than the buddhi. So it's kind of like a tidal wave comes, and the buddhi has been just totally penetrated and saturated by that complex. And so it's the complex speaking. The buddhi is as though push off to the side.
Yeah.
But there comes a time when the buddhi is not overwhelmed by the complex, and then the buddhi holds the complex, can talk to it, and it just starts, at that point it's on its way to losing its power. It has less and less energy.
I've been working with some of that. Last time you mentioned kind of a meditation where I would notice, you know, some complex coming up and take a breath and then speak kindly.
Yeah.
You know, and I've done that quite a bit in the last few days. And my question is, to whom am I speaking kindly?
It depends on what's upset. Like, say, for instance, something's upsetting you and you're feeling hurt and angry.
Well, what seemed to come up was these tapes, you know, you're not doing enough, or you're not good enough, you know. And I could recognize that, oh, that's that one again.
Yeah.
And then I'd speak as if to my little child, because it's coming from the unconscious.
Yeah.
But I wasn't quite sure about speaking to my mind. I know I'm not speaking to Atma, because Atma...
But you're speaking to a part of your mind. Let's say like this. Say, if you use... That's called tongling, that type of meditation. But say, like, for instance, this... kind of a painful and aggravating voice comes in, you know, you're just not doing enough.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of... And then, how are we going to hold that? Like, there's lots of different techniques we can use for that. This one that I was telling last week is just one of them. But what this one does is, instead of trying to push that feeling away, you know, or put it in the closet, or get rid of it in some way, you just allow that... fully allow that to be there, and that's what that breathing in represents. When you breathe it in, there's nobody pushing it away. There's somebody totally taking that whole thing in.
Holding,
breathing it in, and then breathing out, you know, some love and compassion toward that one that's feeling that way, you know. So it dissipates the stress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the wanting to keep away. And it's also giving some peace and love to it, which is what it all wants anyway. That's what the mind wants. It wants to be accepted. Breathing in is that act of accepting. And breathing out is breathing out kind of that holding love. You know, and so you're really, just by that simple act, reducing the problem, right? Because it's one big problem that's pain upon pain is when we're trying to, you have something's happening you don't like, and so you want to, you get rid of it or react on top of it, like a reaction on a reaction on a reaction like that, that's creating more and more problems. What if you just say, all right, here it is, and then don't push it away, just take it in. I've actually found that to be incredibly helpful. and fast. Mm-hmm. You know, it just cuts through.
And you might have to do a couple of runs like that.
Yeah. You might just sit there and do it for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it just breaks down all of the resistance, you know, the pushing away and the, you know,
you
rejecting.
You want to fix it.
Yeah. It just, right. It just holds it, you know.
Is that a cultural thing or is that natural, you know, to want to fix it and push it away?
Well, I mean, we have all kinds of defense systems. We always want to push away pain, you know, but sometimes in the psyche, if you're trying to push away pain or anger or all of these things, then it just gets more and more isolated and more angry and more upset. But if you don't try to push it away, you know, the problem much it minimizes the problem, right? It diffuses it.
Rather that big tsunami wave when that overwhelm, that's like your body just can't
handle it.
Can't handle it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like just a wave that just takes you. I don't care what tools you have.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't care how many times you go to class a week.
Yeah.
Just takes you.
Yeah, that's right.
Fall asleep, get drunk, what?
Uh-huh. Well, no, you don't want to fall asleep or get drunk. I mean, you can just go to bed. That's not a bad
idea. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, it doesn't work for me, but some people it works. It cuts me off. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
But actually, that breathing is helpful for that. For
okay, good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is. You. It is helpful for that. But also, I think the background knowledge that this too will pass. These things, you know, we think that these things are permanent, and they're not permanent. They pass. You know, and so just even that little statement, or even just the act of breathing it in, is also a statement of this will pass. You
know? Yeah.
But breathing it in is so good because it just diffuses it, diffuses the problem. Just that simple act of acceptance, because it's an act of acceptance.
You sit the breath and the mind. At the one point you said something about the breath and the mind.
Oh, I said the breath and the mind are connected.
Yeah, that's what
very
you said.
Very connected.
How,
and so
how could you quickly?
It's just something that's very well known, especially in India and with pranayama. We see that, like for instance, when your mind is angry or upset, right, the breath also is agitated.
Yes.
When your mind is quiet, like say when you're doing a meditative practice, your mind becomes quiet and your breath becomes quiet. Your breath almost disappears. You can't even notice it.
Mm.
You know? And so there's a correlation between the nature of the mind and the nature of the breath. So that being so, normally we can control our mind to control our breath, but we can also control our breath to control our mind. See what I mean? Because the two are connected.
Yeah. That's the switch, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the breath becomes something very useful for deeply absorbing the mind. And the pranayama is really quite... There's simple pranayamas, which I can teach because anybody can teach them. There's also a complex pranayama, which you need to be taught by a teacher who knows what they're doing. But, you know, pranayama is sophisticated in the Ashtanga Yoga and the Patanjali Yoga Sutras.
I'll just do what you do.
But they're simple ones that are very powerful. They're not. You don't have to worry about them harming you or throwing your system out of balance. You know? You notice, you just, like say, if you just this very simple one of breathe in and out each to a count of four. Just that consistent breathing in and out to a count. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Let your breath be even like that. And it'll just be, everything will become so quiet. And you can do the, you know, the holding on the kumbha, they call kumbhakal, so the holding. One, two, three, four. One, hold for four. Exhale for four. Hold for four. Inhale for four. Hold for four. Exhale for four. Like that. Just, they're very simple. But they're effective, you know. But those are different exercises than this breathing, just breathing in. That's a different.
I like this what you're yeah. doing. Clear, simple, clear.
Yeah.
So you've discussed swargam, we would have these sessions for one week and have a 1.5 hour break. Instead of having a session for 1.5 hours and having a 1 week break.
Yeah. That's why it's nice to be when you get to be at a camp or something where you can just. The camps are nice. It pulls you away from reality and just plops you into a place, but you know, where you can just have teaching as kind of just a consistent part of your life for a week. But it's also nice to have just a lifestyle that has a lot of teaching in it. But it's also your life. Your lifestyle has a lot of teaching in it.
I'm not clear what you're saying.
No, I was just thinking, probably because what I was saying, I had a lot of things going on in my own head, and I only said a little bit of it, so that's why you didn't follow. What I was saying is that if you go to a camp, which that's like we've been to Swamiji's, we've been to a camp, what's beautiful about that is that it pulls you out of the life, and then for, you know, that 1 or 2 weeks, you get to just have classes. You know, and just live in an ashram and have classes. But the difference about it is that it isn't your life. It's right. You're coming out of your life,
yeah,
and living in that protected environment, which is wonderful. But it'd be nice, it's nice to try to create your life, to have in your life enough of, you know, enough of that teaching in it. You know, that so that it's part of, but it still has to be your life. That's the thing.
Yeah.
It has to be your life.
As we are doing now.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. It's hard because we're all so busy. You know, but still.
But
still,
it's a blessing we got the punya to be able to sort of have that sort of a lifestyle that we do have.
Yeah. I had a lot of things in the background when I was saying that. One of the things was when I was went that last time to Sweden, I'll probably go this time also. And we were there was a 10-day camp. And I had this little, like this little kutir out in the woods. You know, and I would just get up in the morning and go. It's just a little kutir that opened up into the woods. It was so beautiful. This little tiny thing. Like a little shack that they built themselves. It was very neat. And so then I'd get up early in the morning and go out and get it. They'd have these tea. I'd get a cup of tea and then I'd go and give a meditation in class. And then we'd have another class at 11. And then we'd have another class at 5. So, you know, and then we'd eat together and I'd go and get these classes and then meet with people and just day after day after day, and that's what we did. And I was thinking, this is really nice. This is a very nice life. Yeah.
No, dealing with traffic and thinking, what are we going to have for dinner and shopping?
No. None of that. And of course, well, it's true at the ashram also, but at this little place where we had this retreat. So they brought in some cooks, really, you know, a couple of young people who were cooks. They did all the cooking for us and everything, you know. So it was like in Swargaloka. Just everything. It was nice.
And there was no TV, no politics.
No TV,
no,
no politics.
No.
Yeah, and just a very peaceful. It's out in the way out in the countryside, you know. So.
Oh, no wonder you want to go back there.
we want to go too.
Let's go.
Let's go to Sweden.
I'll say I'm bringing all my friends with me. Get a couple more trailers.
What about Colorado? How is it there, Colorado?
Oh, that was so sweet. Yeah, that was so nice. Yeah. My niece, my niece gave her like a 23-day yoga certificate trainings with another girl who's a trained teacher. You know, and that was a beautiful thing too. Those the kids that were there, all young, they were all the same age. They're all 25. With a couple of exceptions, there was a couple of, you know, women, and I think it was two women in their 40s, but all, everybody else was 25, and my niece is 26, and the other woman that was doing it was 26 or 27, so all in that age group, you know, and they had class every morning and yoga throughout the day, and they had such a wonderful time. I had a great time when I was there too.
Well, you were like an elder then.
Yeah, I was an elder. They treated me like an elder too.
A 26-year-old in a sort of an elderly body.
But it was so nice, and it was to see all the them bonding also. All that group of kids bonding, you know, and making deep friendships, and so inquisitive about Vedanta, and really wanting to learn. It was really nice.
Mm. So there's hope for this world.
There is.
Mm. Yes.
There really is. I noticed that at CIS too, there's some really wonderful, wonderful young people. A lot of the students there are just in their 20s. It used to be, CIS used to be, have much more of a range, and a lot of people in their 40s and 50s. Now those people are there, but the majority of the people there are in their 20s and early 30s, so the demographics have changed a little bit. Yeah, but
oh, the baby boomers are gone.
That's us. We're on the way out.
They're at Rossmore.
Yeah, Rossmore's next.
What's Rossmore?
It's the big senior community.
It's the senior community,
oh,
too.
Okay. Oh, well, that's good. That's good. Being looked after.